From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the story of Germany's Weimar Republic, 1919 to 1933, is always one to strike fear in the hearts of democracy lovers. A German democracy, born in defeat in World War I, fragile in a decade of high hopes and polarized politics, crushed by Nazis. All true. But there's beauty here, too, and liberation. A new history tells the story. This hour, On Point, before Hitler, democracy and the Weimar Republic. Joining me now in the studio is Eric Weitz, a professor of history at the University of Minnesota. He's author of the new book, Weimar Germany, Promise and Tragedy. The New York Times calls it history at its best. Eric Weitz, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. hello, Press Weitz.
Hello.
Eric Weitz, take us back to the beginning. It gets Americans' attention these days. The origins of this democracy against a backdrop of a German history that was anything but friendly to democracy.
That's true. To be sure, Germany was an authoritarian system by and large between 1871 and its collapse in 1918. But there were also very strong democratic currents in the period of what we call Imperial Germany, when Kaiser Wilhelm I and Kaiser Wilhelm II ruled Germany.
You describe this moment late in World War I, where two senior German military commanders are kind of sitting around plotting how they can fob what they see coming, right, which is defeat, right, how they can fob it off on the democratic opposition. What happened there?
Well, the two senior commanders whom you refer to, Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg and Erich Ludendorff, had essentially exercised a dictatorship over Germany since 1916, midway through World War I. And they finally come to the recognition that Germany is unable to continue World War I. They should have recognized that 4 years earlier at the Battle of the Marne in September 1914, but it took them longer to figure it out. And then they decide that the only way that Germany has any chance of getting a reasonable peace is by approaching the Americans.
The English won't give it to them. The British, the French won't do it.
The French absolutely won't give it to them, but maybe the Americans. President Wilson had issued his 14 points and his call for a peace without annexations and indemnities. And they know that the only way that they can speak to the Americans, that the Americans will respond, is if the Americans see some democratic reforms in Germany. And at the same time, they are indeed trying to foist the responsibility for Germany's defeat onto the new democratic forces.
We're going to look at what took off under that democracy, what flowered in the Weimar Republic, Weimar Germany. But you point to a compromise that the forces of democracy made very early on in this terrible post-war period for Germany, when it was so beaten down, when such huge numbers of men had come home either dead or not at all or severely wounded. There was a fundamental structural compromise made by the Democrats. What was it?
Right. I think the first thing to point out is to remind everyone that Germany did indeed have a revolution. There was a mass revolution on the streets in the very last days of World War I. It sent the Kaiser off into exile. It brought the Social Democrats to power.
A revolution that began when, at the end of the war, workers stood up and said, or sailors stood up and said, no, we're not going to go out for one more mission and die for this crazy war.
Right. The German fleet had basically done nothing during World War I except sink American shipping, which wasn't a very smart strategy. And sailors, indeed, in the very last days of the war, mutinied and refused to stoke up the boilers and set out to sea.
And it spread right through industrial Germany.
Right through industrial Germany. You can actually track the movements of the revolution by train schedules to see sailors moving out of the port city of Kiel to various German cities.
Now, it was interesting to me that the forces of democracy, on the one hand, it was very exciting to them to see this uprising of people against authoritarian rule. On the other hand, the image of Russian revolution was very frightening to them. They didn't want workers out of control.
Exactly. The Social Democrats who took power in the winter of 1918-19 were deeply committed to democracy. They were also committed to socialism, but they imagined a slow evolutionary transition to socialism. And in this crisis moment of Germany's defeat, of all the problems of post-war reconstruction, their slogan was no experiments, because they did, as you pointed out, fear a Bolshevik revolution in Germany. Now, that was completely unrealistic, at least in retrospect, but that did drive many of their decisions. And they then made a series of compromises.
With whom?
With the old forces of order. Primarily, that means the military officers, high state officials in the bureaucracy, and Germany's business elite. Now, these forces were not just anti-socialist, anti-Bolshevik. They were, by and large, deeply anti-democratic. And they made these compromises in the crisis situation. But it was a fateful compromise that the Social Democrats undertook because it meant that these traditional, powerful, anti-democratic elites retained their bases of power
society. Let's flip ahead to the end of the story before we come back and look at the body of this era. And the end of the Weimar Republic, the end of what turned out to be, after all, an experiment, whether that's what they intended or not, saw the Nazi Party come to power. Give us the dynamics of the end time for Weimar. What happened?
Right. The expression one often hears, that Weimar collapsed, is precisely the wrong expression, I argue in the book, the wrong metaphor. This was not collapse. Weimar was overthrown. It was destroyed. It was destroyed by a coalition of these old established conservatives, the businessmen or officers whom I just mentioned, who then threw in their lot with the radical right, with the Nazis.
Hitler.
With Hitler in particular, yes, whom they, of course, thought they could control. Mm-hmm. They would not be able to control him. They got much more than they bargained for initially. But at that crisis, another crisis moment, 1932, 33, the depths of the Depression, the old conservative elite, made a very conscious political choice, and that choice was to join with the Nazis, with Adolf Hitler, and they brought Hitler to power. Germans never, quote-unquote, elected the Nazis to power, an expression one often hears also.
They never got a majority.
They never got a majority vote in a free election. The most they ever got was 37.4% in the summer of 1932. That is a large chunk, to be sure, but it's not a majority. It's not how you get to power in a parliamentary system, as the Weimar Republic still was at that point.
So it was kind of taken by the bully boys and forced once they got that platform.
Correct. And that was the tragic consequence of the compromises that the Social Democrats made in the winter of 1918-19.
And from there, we all know the story, anything but democracy, the Third Reich, Hitler's, the Nazis' continued rise, German armies on the march, and World War II. Jack Beatty, look back on this period with us for a second. You know, for decades now, especially after what we saw unfold in World War II, people look back on Weimar with all sorts of mixed feelings of sorrow, admiration, pity, regret, you name it. But it stands as such an icon.
It is. It's a sort of symbol of what can happen in a how people can lose democracy, and you know, to me, the visual symbol, Eric, in your book is on page 320. The picture of these young women leaping in the air. Uh-huh. It's a Hans Suren photograph of the von Leben dance school, and these young women are leaping off the ground, bare legs, hands soaring toward the sky. It reminds us of the new woman, who's such a big part of your story, of artistic expression, such a big part of Weimar, of freedom, crucial to it, and yet what a terribly short hang time. They're up, they're off the ground, but they're coming down, and it seems so poignant that just that picture of this brief moment of glory, of transcendence, of transcending their history, and then down.
Eric, describe that feeling of freedom that was in the air during those years. This wasn't thought of as just another political move. This was liberation time.
This was indeed liberation, and depending on whom one talks to or whom one reads now, you know, whether it's a painter, an architect, a poet, a politician even, each of them thought that his or her genre could be the way of creating a more humane, a better future. And those utopian strivings were so important to the creation of what we call Weimar culture. In other words, this was not a society only marked by despair. There was despair galore, to be sure, coming out of World War I and all the economic crises of the Republic itself. But at the same time, That revolution in 1918-19 marked the fundamental break with the old authoritarian order, and that was liberating. The sense of creating something new was liberating, and it inspired Weimar's great intellectuals and artists to produce some of their greatest works.
How long did most Germans, if they did they think, oh, we're on to something new and wonderful, we're building a new democracy, it's going to be beautiful, and we're headed for a utopia, and it's going to last? How long did that?
I would say that lasted probably until the Great Depression, which comes to Germany, of course, very rapidly from the United States in the winter of 1929-30. Germany was the country the most affected by the terrible economic impact of the Depression. And the Republic lingers for another 2.5 years, but it's a tough lingering where lots of people are trying to figure out what should come next.
We're talking this hour about the fragile democracy that came before Hitler in Germany, the time of Cabaret and Marlene Dietrich and Dreams of Freedom, the decade and more of the Weimar Republic, born in war and killed in economic depression and the rise of the Nazis. My guest is Eric Weitz. His new book, New History, is Weimar Germany, Promise and Tragedy. Jack Beattie's here. Eric Weitz, we went out of the last segment with, of course, Marlene Dietrich, the song from The Blue Angel, 1939. Mm-hmm. You know, that whole sort of cabaret sound is for many Americans because of popular culture, cabaret, the movie, and all the rest. That sort of cabaret, semi-debauched culture is kind of emblematic of Weimar. Is that fair? What role did that play? What's the bigger picture of the arts there?
It's only partly true. Mm-hmm. It's fair to a degree. Certainly, Weimar had this thriving cabaret scene, and we still hear its impact. In fact, I know Germans who think that the Doors' rendition of the Alabama Song was written by Jim Morrison. It's actually a Brecht Weil composition that comes from Mahagoni. Mm. But what always bothers me, and part of the reason I wrote this book, is the sense that Weimar is only, quote-unquote, degeneracy, the demi-monde, the cabaret scene. It was all that, and that was inspiring as well. But one can look at modern architecture. One can look at the Brecht Weil compositions. One can look at Heidegger's Being and Time.
Mm-hmm. Philosophy.
Mm-hmm. If you think about it, 1925 was the year Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain was published, 1927, Heidegger's Being and Time, 1928, the Threepenny Opera premiere.
Kurt Weill.
I mean, it's a concentration of such fundamentally important works that we still read, that we still view, that we still listen to, and that still have meaning for us today. So alongside the cabaret scene, we need to recall Weimar producing these great works as well.
What was the message in the high arts, the high production of this time, and what was the message in the low, what was called debauched?
I think low and high, they're all wrestling with the same thing, which is, how does one live in modern times? How does one live in a society now where the focal point is the city, the fast-paced city, with all of the tensions and conflicts of modern life, a society in which most people now are working for a wage or a salary, not working or living on a farm. They're all wrestling with what is the meaning of that. One sees it in Being and Time, one sees it in Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, even though Magic Mountain is really set in a 19th century world, or at least the pre-World War I world. It's still, what does it mean? How do we live in the modern era?
And what's the answer that Weimar found? Nazism?
There is no simple answer. There is no simple answer. But I think what is so appealing about the great cultural figures is the depth with which they deal with this question. And you get different answers. An architect like Erich Mendelssohn, who built some of the most beautiful modern structures in the 1920s, says very clearly, we can't go back to prior times. We can't only have
no more agrarian idol.
No, we can't have an architecture that just reproduces historical styles of the past. We need an architecture that speaks to our own time. We need to grasp the modern. And at the same time, he says we need to build beautiful structures that will also soothe the tensions of modern life, that in their beauty will also calm the frayed nerves of living in the hectic urban spaces of the 1920s.
Jack Beatty, all of Europe beaten to the ground by World War I, but Germany stripped down deeper than anyone else, and they're in that kind of, you know, naked point wrestling with modernity.
Yes, and I'm struck again and again in reading this, Eric, how the sort of basic grammar for understanding and talking about modernity seems to be created in this period. You have right. Heidegger making these striking observations about the way in which a kind of they, a sort of impersonal mass, invades all of us when we're in public. You have somebody else thinking about how the incitements to erotic feeling in daily life, which of course was a function of the new woman, of new dress and so on, how that atrophies, or he feared it would, the sexual feelings. Yeah, again, that's a common preoccupation of modern life. You've got this fear of the mass man, this contempt that the intellectuals have for the sort of average person, which I think has been a feature of our life. So it's as if modernity was discovered then, but also the language by which people try to understand modernity.
I think that's precisely right. And the passage you point to in Heidegger's Being and Time is quite interesting, and it has this immense rhetorical power. I mean, Heidegger even despises newspapers and public transportation. To him, they are the basic emblems of modernity that indeed crush individuality. But then you have someone like Kurt Weill, who's head over the heels in love with American jazz, and you can hear the strain and what America, of course, symbolizes the modern more than any place else for Europeans in the 1920s and 1930s. And Weill's adoption of jazz elements in his compositions indicates this enthrallment with the modern.
Where did sexuality and the body fall in that kind of spectrum of views? Were high and low both embracing them? Why so front and center in Weimar Germany?
Probably no issue was more controversial, more contested, and contributed more finally to the demise of the Republic than these issues of sex and the bodies. Most of the very creative individuals in Weimar culture had their training and had started their professional careers before World War I. And that certainly includes a large number of sex reformers, mostly physicians, who wrote about what they called sexual misery, the sexual misery that most Germans lived through, who had no understanding of basic biology, who had no understanding of eroticism, and no capability in their cramped apartments of most working class and poor people, no capability to lead an erotic life.
Why did that seem so important to thinkers of such stature at this time?
Because they believed that part of Germany's problem was this sexual misery. In other words, this was
repression.
Not just a problem of individuals and of couples, but that a free, humane society would also be an erotically fulfilled society. So their writings and speeches and the health clinics they founded to spread this knowledge among Germans is directly associated with their deep-seated conviction that freedom, progress, meant also an erotic life.
So here's a path to freedom, path to progress,
right.
And pretty soon we see Jack pointed out just one of the photographs, but Germany was famous around the world in those days for churning out, you know, all kinds of photos of leaping naked people expressing freedom.
Right. I mean, there is an open public discussion about sex in the 1920s that is perhaps unsurpassed even to our own day. And in going back, reading some of the works and looking at the photographs, I'm left wondering whether we've actually advanced all that much since the 1920s. Now, of course, a lot of this was anathema to others, particularly religious people, and the churches were still very powerful institutions in German society, and they thought all this sex talk was, you know, the end of Western civilization, the end of German civilization, and they foisted the responsibility for that onto the Republic.
Let's begin to turn to our callers. Tug is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Tug, you're on the air.
Hi, Tug. Tom, Jack, and Eric.
Hello, Doug.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
Fine. It's been a long time.
It's been many years.
Oh, we got a reunion going on. Great, great. What do you know, Doug? What's the relationship?
Well, we went together to graduate school at BU. And both were in the PhD program, and Eric finished and went on to an illustrious career and wrote this wonderful book, which I've just got and I'm about to read.
It is wonderful.
And I'm delighted to hear his voice. You can call me and let's have lunch.
Okay.
Good. What do you think about our subject here, Tuck?
Well, my father was actually a Weimar German who left in 1934, grew up there with an old German-Jewish family. Mm-hmm. And he was a theoretical physicist, and he actually took his degree with Einstein as his professor and Schrödinger and all these other greats.
Not too bad.
Which shows what a tremendous amount of brain power there was focused in Berlin and in the rest of Germany at that time. Mm. Here's my question for Eric and you guys. Two questions, actually. Number one, to what extent was this glory of Weimar culture Jewish? What extent did the Jewish community, though small, play in that? And number two, when Eric goes back to Berlin, I know he goes now to Berlin, does he see today in the revival in Berlin echoes of the Weimar culture?
Interesting. In Germany's new prosperity.
Many of the creative figures were certainly Jewish. There's no question about that. But it was not only Jewish. I mean, Jewish was the term foisted on Weimar's creative cultural elite by its opponents. But, yeah, we have individuals like Brecht, Bruno Taut, the architect, and many others. The harder question is whether this is a Jewish milieu in a sense, and I think not. Part of the reason Weimar culture was so phenomenally creative has to do with Germany's phenomenally well-developed educational system as it developed over the 19th century and then became open around the turn into the 20th century to Jews, to other outsiders. So someone like Kurt Weill, again, you know, had the best musical training that the Western world had to offer. The architects, Gropius, Mendelssohn, others also, the best kind of training that the Western world had to offer. So I think much of the reason lies in the larger German society and educational system.
How did Germans understand that? Was the Jewish cultural role during Weimar a subject of popular remark and discussion before the Nazis raised it up and made it anathema or not?
Yes, absolutely. For example, Bruno Taut built these wonderful public housing developments, which one can still see in Berlin. And in Zehlendorf, in the western part of the city, he built one development. And then there emerged the so-called Zehlendorf roof wars. That is, with some people saying that flat roofs, as Taut built, although Taut was not Jewish, were un-German, Jewish, a sign of degeneracy. A true German architecture rooted in the German people had peaked roofs. So these kind of attacks indeed predated the Nazis and were widely disseminated. Like everything else in Weimar, culture was contested. Even architecture was contested.
We'll come to the Berlin question, but of course the fate of the Jews in World War II, a tragedy of such magnitude. As a historian, I know that part of your view of this period is you do not like it to be seen simply as a prelude to the
Absolutely.
Third Reich and Nazism and so on. But as you read the history, as you go through it, do you feel it year by year marching as a prelude toward the terrible fate of the Jews, or was that
undestined? I absolutely don't. I think the Nazi victory was not inevitable, and that in part is the greatest tragedy of all. It did not have to happen. The Nazis, as I mentioned earlier, were placed into power by an old elite, but there was certainly nothing inevitable about that. So, no, I don't see the Third Reich looming inevitably. It's what came to be, but it did not have to be.
Berlin today, echoes of Weimar?
Not echoes of Weimar in the sense of the political fragmentation and the dangers to democracy. Germany is a solid democratic society these days. Echoes of Weimar in the very, very lively artistic and cultural scene today. It's a lot of fun to go to Germany, to go to Berlin.
We hope you get that lunch with your old classmate, and thanks for calling. Let's get another. Michael is calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, I first quickly comment that I've always been irked at the people, even to this day, who act as if Nazism were punishment for sexual impropriety during the Weimar Republic.
They were naughty and they got spanked.
The worst sort of religious magical thinking, and very, very useful for fascists. Speaking of echoes of Weimar, I realize you can't draw exact analogies between the past and the present, but during the Weimar period, there was the, I think it's Dostos Legend, the legend of the stab in the back by the socialists and degenerates and other forms of Jew. And the American right were really good at this, using the same sort of thing after Vietnam. As an historian of the earlier period, do you see the same thing being done for Iraq as we speak?
Eric, remind us of the whole stab in the back political dialogue of that time, and then the echoes question.
And that takes us back to your very first question today, which is that the stab in the back legend actually began right when the two military commanders in September 1917 went to the Kaiser and said, in 1918, and said the war was lost, and tried to foist the responsibility for the defeat onto socialists, Jews, pacifists, and others. So it began.
I mean, when they told the Kaiser it was those people's fault, or they told the public, or both?
They began spreading this notion in military circles and high governmental circles. We know that from later investigations, parliamentary inquiries. And then it gets picked up very, very quickly by all sorts of elements on the right, and then most successfully, of course, by the Nazis. I wouldn't make a direct analogy, but I do think it is indeed always a worrisome mood when those who have great power, who sit in the halls of government, start trying to foist responsibility for their mistakes onto others. I think indeed we can see that today with some of the language coming out of President Bush, out of Vice President Cheney. I think that is indeed a dangerous move.
Jack Beatty, Weimar gets a lot of discussion lately in certain quarters in this country.
It does. In recent weeks, Neil Ferguson just yesterday used a Weimar analogy to Russia. George Will was talking about it when General Petraeus was testifying, our Weimar moment, he said. and you know, as I kept reading it, I kept hearing echoes in the language used then and the language today, the language of extremity. And, for example, here's a right-wing paper. We must learn to hate our enemies abroad, but we must also punish the domestic enemies of Germany with our hatred and our contempt. Compromise is impossible. Well, you know, Norman Podhoretz has recently written a book in which he says that the fight against the domestic enemies, meaning liberals here, is every bit as serious as the fight against the jihadists there, and there can be no compromise with them. The same sort of radical language.
We're talking this hour about the fragile democracy that came before Hitler in Germany, the decade and more of the Weimar Republic. My guest is Eric Weitz, a historian. His new book is Weimar, Germany, Promise and Tragedy. He's professor of history at the University of Minnesota with me in the studio today. Jack Beatty's here. I should say, just briefly, we went out of that last segment with the Three Penny Opera, of course, Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht, and that was the Kanonen song, and it had you bouncing along a little bit there, Eric Weitz.
Yeah, the Kanonen song, Kanonenlied, is one of my favorites from the Three Penny Opera, and it's very important because it expresses the total anti-militaristic sentiment of Brecht and Weill and many of their listeners and viewers in their day.
This is 1928, almost a decade after the end of World War I, and they're still bitter about it.
They're still bitter about it, but when one thinks about the long, honored tradition of the Prussian and German military in German history, I mean, it's wonderful to have this song that just skewers militaristic values. And Weill wrote others, Potsdam was the garrison, the Prussian garrisons, Potsdam under the oak trees. That's just complete satire also of military values. Ute Lemper sings it these days. And it just, for me, shows us again the positive, progressive, emancipatory aspects of Weimar culture that did not simply kowtow to militaristic values in German society.
Let's take a call from Augusta, Georgia. Atnur, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see? What do you know?
What I want to say is today's Germany is also a failure for democracy and the freedom, I believe. The reason why is if any German citizen or any resident of Germany is married to any other foreign country people, and these people, when they get married, they cannot come into Germany because they will have to speak German. They will have to know German to get to Germany.
Adner, are you talking about the way that immigrants to Germany are received and treated today? Maybe, of course, many Turkish immigrants there?
Not only Turkish, which is all foreigners. I'm not talking about all the Turkish ones. It's just the law for all the foreigners, I think, that one right now in Germany. And I believe that before the World War II, it was like blue eyes, blonde hair, was choosing people, like that's the way they believed it. And today is the same situation, but different subject. Like only German language speaking people is the one choosing people. It's kind of like that's a big factor for freedom. Democracy.
Let me get Eric Weitz's response there.
Germany today is a multicultural society. There's no question about that. And it's taken a long time for the political system and older Germans to come to grips with that. The immigration laws are restrictive. They were reformed around 2000, made a bit more reasonable. Germany still has a long way to go on this issue.
Atner's not so sure that it's changed as much as it might think.
I wouldn't say that. It has changed enormously. But as in other European countries, France, Holland, we've seen the events there in the last few years, that this is a difficult process of adaptation.
Let's take a call from Shalom in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shalom, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I congratulate you on choice of the topic because I feel it's very, very relevant to our time. Even so, history does not repeat itself. It does offer a lesson. And I think we are in maybe similar danger that democracy was the time of Weimar Republic. The Weimar Republic was lost first internally, and then 55 million people lost their lives because of the appeasement by Churchill. By appeasement by Chamberlain. Churchill tried to warn against it, but didn't get through. I have in front of me Chamberlain's book of speeches called In Search of Peace. Came out less than four months before Germany attacked Poland.
So what's the lesson you draw today from the fall of Weimar, Shalom?
My lesson is the lesson of favorite book of Gandhi, Bhagavad Gita, the lesson to Arjuna to face the people who want to fight and destroy you. I am a lifelong liberal, but I believe that Weimar Republic and European democracy committed suicide but not facing with force those who threaten with force.
So when Hitler had his bully boys in the streets, what would you have had the Weimar Democrats do?
I would have kept him in prison. He was released after he tried to overthrow the Weimar Republic in 23. Just gave him enough time to write Mein Kampf. He was released. Rosa Luxemburg was murdered. Rathenau, the Jewish foreign minister, was murdered. The murderers got away with murder. And Hindenburg appointed Hitler. This shouldn't be forgotten. And Heidegger, the greatest philosopher of the time, joined the Nazi party in 1932.
Shalom, let us pick it up. Our time is short. You make great points. And Eric Weitz, what's your response? You do say in the book, you say, Weimar did not just collapse. It was killed off. But Shalom says it could have, should have fought back more vigorously for the democracy it represented.
I would agree that it should have fought back more strongly for the democracy it represented. We have to be clear about the lessons, though. Everybody wants to take a lesson out of Weimar.
Sure.
And Jack referred to some other lessons from conservative commentators. If you Google Weimar America, you quickly get all sorts of very strange and dangerous sounding web pages up there.
You mean people taking right-wing conclusions from it?
It was debauched
then and needed to be cleaned up and now the same.
The kind of virulent language of the right against liberals and other Democrats that Jack mentioned a few minutes ago, yes, one finds that very, very quickly on the website and then in commentators like Norman Podhoretz, whom he mentioned. That, I think, is very dangerous. That is one of the lessons. This elevation of political differences to existential conflicts, where you take no quarter, where you refuse to even talk with your opponent, as long as the opponent is on the, you know, is in the same ballpark of democracy, that's one problem. But the other problem is that democracy is so often threatened internally before it is threatened externally. And what I write about in the book is indeed those conservative forces who still disposed of great resources, who still had great power, yet complained all the time, whined all the time about Weimar democracy. We have to be careful of those people as well.
Jack, what do you say?
Well, I think that's part of the as our caller from Cambridge said, one of the lessons. Perhaps history doesn't repeat itself, but it has this strange quality of plagiarism, of seeming to. As I was going through this, I was just jotting things down. The craving people had for unity, for Germanness, and the idea of if we can only find some national essence, it will transcend all this talking shop conflict in Congress, and we'll are in the Parliament, and will rise to unity. You hear that again and again from Americans. I heard it during the Ken Burns documentary on World War II. I heard people saying, if only we could be that unified again. What's the matter with us? Well, you know, there's something to be said for diversity, for life, for change, and so on. And then this business of emergency, the feeling that the government from 1930 on really governed in a state of emergency, and how central that was to the Nazi rise. It enabled it. The feeling of, my God, we're in an emergency. These are desperate
All
conditions.
Bets are off. All rules
all bets
by
are
the wayside.
We can't let rules hold us up now. We've got to waterboard or whatever it is, but we've got to win. That echo really, I could feel that.
The call for an essence of unity may have potentially hold a danger. And at the same time, Eric, you point out the polarization was really a problem during this period.
There's no question about it that the polarization was a great problem.
You couldn't have a national conversation or a respectful conversation as you describe it.
Right. But at the same time, that polarization was very productive of some of the great artworks that we've mentioned, some of the deep thinking that we've mentioned. There is this contradiction between the deep-seated problems of Weimar politics and economics on the one hand, and on the other, the enormous cultural productivity. And I would say that, very stable, very self-satisfied, sleepy societies, and there are such things.
Yes.
They're not so conducive to questioning, to probing, to the great cultural works that Weimar produced.
We would celebrate it more if it weren't for the disaster that came after. Gerald is calling from Danvers, Massachusetts. Gerald, you're on the air.
Well, hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Oh, good, thank you. I'll make my point quick. I don't know if you gentlemen have read a book. It's called Modern Times by Paul Johnson. He's written several books on political history. And Mr. Johnson makes a very interesting point that if Weimar hadn't been faced by Hitler in 1932-33, it probably would have survived simply because Hitler had such a dynamic, incredible will to power that all his opponents didn't have one-tenth of his determination, which is why they're overwhelmed by him. You know, anyone but him, they probably would have survived, at least at that time.
Are you saying, Gerald, that there's no way Weimar could resist this one single man and his fabulous will?
Yes, I think that it's a very valid point. He makes a comparison between Lenin in Russia in 1917 when he seized power from the Social Democrats there. And again, if they had not been faced by him at that time and place, they probably would have survived, because there was no other group or person or individual that had this incredible... Even some of the Bolsheviks in Russia hesitated to seize power. It was Lenin that drove them all the time. So probably democracy in Russia would have survived 1917, at least at that time. Perhaps they wouldn't have survived later. Same with Weimar. I think in 1933, if they had been faced by anyone but Hitler, just they'd not been faced by Lenin in Russia, Social Democrats in both cases, probably would have survived at that time.
Let us turn to that, Gerald, and thank you. Eric Weitz, what about anybody but Hitler? It would have survived, but this guy was just too much. What do you make of that perspective?
I respectfully disagree. To be sure, Hitler had great political capabilities. But in the fall of 1932, The Nazi Party's surge had broken. The party seemed on the verge of breaking up. There were challenges to Hitler's authority from within the Nazi Party. In the end, again, it's the established conservatives who bring the Nazis to power. Democracy rarely is destroyed solely by an extreme right-wing party. It is destroyed by those within the system who are opposed to the system. This was true of Italy in 1922 when Mussolini came to power. There are countless examples from Eastern Europe in the 1920s and 30s, and it is certainly true of Germany in this
period.
Didn't
those establishment conservatives sense the danger that the Nazi Party also represented? I mean, it ended up leaving the whole country crushed again. It was a bad bet. Didn't they have any sense
it was a bad bet that most of them stayed with to the very end?
Why? What was so repellent to them about Weimar democracy that they would place their bet with Hitler?
Everything we've been talking about in this last hour and everything I wrote about in the book. With a few exceptions.
But this was not all in your face shocking. It wasn't so.
No, it was not. But Weimar was associated with the emancipatory spirit in sex, in art, in architecture, and that was anathema to these established conservatives. They didn't love Hitler. They didn't embrace him happily, necessarily, in January 1933, but they did find his extreme nationalism and even his racism amenable. They did find his anti-democratic positions amenable. They did support his drive to revive Germany's great power status. In all those areas, there was enough agreement, even though they thought Hitler was still a low-class, loose cannon whom they thought they could control.
He would be their cannon. One more call from Conway, South Carolina. Rudy, you're on the air.
Yes, I am really a child of the Weimar Republic. I was born in 1925, and I remember the period quite well. But the sentiment that was not mentioned here was what the Germans called the Versailler Zwangsvertrag, the dictated peace that made sure that Germany handed over all kinds of, economic, I don't know how to express that. It demanded that coal be delivered to the French, this be delivered to someone else.
Oh, the reparations of World War One, the price that the West demanded, yeah.
And this has rankled in Germany for the longest time that I remember.
Rudy, where were you born in Germany? Where?
In the outskirts of Cologne, and I remember the Depression quite well with the long line of the Dole, and the sentiment was that if the victorious powers had been somewhat less demanding, had given, like we did with the Marshall Plan, extended a helping hand to Germany, Hitler wouldn't have helped, and it wouldn't have happened. But I would like to find out your guest's opinion of the Clemenceau, whatever it was, that insisted on his pound of flesh.
We'll turn to exactly that, and thank you so much for calling. Eric Weitz, what about it? Of course, this is part of the story we always hear. Rudy says, I was there, I attest to it.
Right. And I think he's completely accurate in his rendition of the events and the sentiments of those times. The only issue, the single issue, on which all Germans could agree, from communists to Nazis, was their hostility toward the Versailles Peace Treaty. And while one can understand the harsh provisions of it from the Allied viewpoint, the French and the Belgians especially, it was a very, very short-sighted treaty. And Allied policy all through the 1920s and even into the 1930s was very short-sighted. Weimar democracy, to survive, needed economic stability, economic progress, and diplomatic understanding. It needed breathing room, and all of those were in precious short supply in the 1920s.
Jack? No, and so much of this sort of revanche was driven by domestic politics. In the 1918 Cocky election in Britain, Lloyd George says, we will squeeze the Germans till the pips squeak. and the pips squeaked all right.
Until they weren't pipsqueaks anymore.
Right, but that was what the electorate wanted to hear, because they had just been through this war into which German militarism had plunged the world.
A fascinating passage in history. If you have one piece of advice for any democracy that doesn't want to share that fate, Eric Weitz, what is it?
be careful of the people internally who have enormous power, sometimes speak the language of democracy, but actually adopt policies that are opposed to democratic practices.
We'll take away that lesson. Eric White's professor of history at the University of Minnesota, his new history, and it is a wonderful book, is Weimar Germany, Promise and Tragedy. Eric White, thank you very much for being
with
us.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beattie, great to have you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jack.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Freilich geht man mit den Jahren leichter auf dem Liebesmarkt und umarmt sie dort in Scharen. Aber das Gefühl bleibt erstaunlich kühl, wenn man damit allzu wenig kargt. Schließlich geht ja jeder Vorrat zu Ende.